Welcome to the Direct Talk podcast. This is Joseph Miller. This week we air a lecture I presented at the Institute of World Culture in Santa Barbara on May 31st, 2014. The Institute of World Culture was co-founded in Santa Barbara in 1976, the United States bicentennial year, by visionary philosopher Raghavan Iyer and his wife Nandini, both professors at UC Santa Barbara at the time. For nearly 40 years, the IWC has presented seminars, lectures, performances, and hosted study groups with the aim of promoting universal fellowship through understanding. A world culture, states its declaration, is greater than the sum of its parts. This lecture is entitled Henry David Thoreau, Still in the Mail, Messages from the Imagination, and centers on Thoreau's first book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, and his correspondence with Harrison Blake. So nice to see such a good turnout this afternoon. It's really inspiring to be able to speak with you about Thoreau. When Professor Dorrance, or I should say President Dorrance, approached me about this, the one stipulation she said was, no Walden. She said, our program, Freedom and Fellowship in a Changing World, we need Thoreau, but no Walden. And I happened at the time to be rereading his letters to Harrison Blake. And so in a moment of weakness, I agreed. I was a little surprised to hear what she said, though, about reform, because for me, Thoreau is all reform. There isn't anything else. In fact, that first title was really a placeholder until I figured out what I wanted to say, because for me, they're equivalent. After all, we do have a whole set of essays of his that are published together called the Reform Papers, which include Civil Disobedience and his defense of John Brown and Life Without Principle and other works. But I don't want to talk about, and of course, he was also involved in the Underground Railroad, and he became more and more active in the abolitionist movement as he got older. But I don't want to talk about that part of him at all today. I want to really just draw from these letters to Harrison Blake and also from his very first book. He only published two books while he was alive, and this is A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, which was a delight. I was forced to read a book that I hadn't ever spent time with before. So that's what I'll get into. And I wanted to start by talking a little bit about this phrase, freedom and fellowship in a changing world, since that's the context that the Institute wanted to put this in. Maybe we think of our modern life as moving at 1,000 miles an hour, but Thoreau's world was changing fast also with the advancing industrial age. You can read his pushback against the railroads in Walden, his swipes at the spinning jenny, which was one of the most important instruments in advancing the industrial age. It was what allowed England to get away from the spinning wheel and make their threads mechanically. His position in history, a few decades into the industrial age, at the edge of breakthroughs in manufacturing, steel, communication, and transportation, this is extremely significant. Thoreau is like a hand poised before the opening of Pandora's box, a gesture of warning. I wouldn't call him a Luddite. Although he wrote a critical review of a book which promised paradise regained through technology, all the problems, Thoreau said, would be solved by the turn of a crank. He retorted, there is a certain divine energy in every man, but sparingly employed as yet, which may be called the crank within. He was an inventor himself, after all, with improvements in pencil manufacturing, which was his family's business. He likely regarded the release of ambition from the Pandora's box of industry as inevitable. And he would not be blind to its advantages, but he seemed to be asking, what do you hope to find in that box? In your excitement, in your fever for profit and distraction, might you overlook yourself? Aren't there some basic human issues that are perennial, that never go away, however much you add to the outer life? Do we wear our technology like a moon man in a spacesuit, and then mistake it for the real self? What would happen if the moon suit was not equipped for respiration, perspiration, urination? It's not like those needs would go away because they're not visible. What about the psychological and emotional needs we have for truth, confidence, security, belongingness, self-expression, love? And what about the spiritual needs for wonder and purpose and self-transcendence? Simplify, simplify is one of the refrains in Walden, because only in an unfeverish and uncluttered state of mind can a person really give those needs an honest hearing. So late in life, Harrison Blake of Worcester, Massachusetts, did I pronounce that right? Worcester?
Worcester.
Worcester? Yeah. It's a lighter?
Mm-hmm.
It's spelled Worcester, but so you can't be fooled by that. Worcester, Massachusetts. Late in life, Harrison Blake reflected on his 13-year correspondence with Henry David Thoreau, the naturalist, essayist, lecturer, lifelong bachelor, and somewhat curmudgeonly recluse of Concord. The two, Blake and Thoreau, had attended Harvard at the same time, but were never acquaintances while they were students there. However, both spirits were ignited by Ralph Waldo Emerson, the brilliant lecturer and writer of Concord. 19-year-old Thoreau read Emerson's essay Nature with tremendous excitement. Blake, who stayed on at Harvard for a master's in divinity, was one of that graduating class famously ravished, and I mean in both senses, some torn and others swooned, by Emerson's divinity school address. An assault of ideas deemed so heretical that New England's most famous man of letters was not invited to the college again to speak for 30 years. Blake was one of the swooners. It was Emerson who introduced the two disciples to one another at his house in Concord 6 or 7 years later, just before Thoreau undertook his Walden Pond experiment. But it was only after Blake read one of Thoreau's early essays, which is ahead another 4 years, an essay which had been printed years earlier in the inaugural issue of The Dial, which was the Transcendentalist's journal. It was only after he read that he initiated the correspondence. 49 letters Blake received from 1848 to 1861, a 13-year period, from a man he looked up to as a teacher and a wiser brother. Looking back 10 years or so after Thoreau had died from tuberculosis at age 45, the devoted Blake, then in his mid-50s, considered an advanced age in the 19th century, he wrote of his friend and their relationship in the following words. As to the outward incidents of our intercourse, I think of little or nothing that seems worthwhile to write. Our conversation, or rather his talking, when we were together, was in the strain of his letters and his books. Our relation, as I look back on it, seems almost an impersonal one, and illustrates well his remark that our thoughts are the epochs of our lives. All else is but a journal of the winds that blew while we were here. When together, we had little inclination to talk of personal matters. Geniality, versatility, personal familiarity are, of course, agreeable in those about us and seem necessary for human intercourse, but I did not miss them in Thoreau, who was, while living, and is still in my recollection, and in what he has left to us, such an effectual witness to what is highest and most precious in life. As I reread his letters from time to time, which I never tire of doing, I'm apt to find new significance in them, am still warned and instructed by them, with more force occasionally than ever before, so that in that sense, they are still in the mail. have not altogether reached me yet, and will not probably before I die. They may well be regarded as addressed to those who can read them best. I was, of course, intrigued by that phrase, still in the mail, and the sense of vigilant anticipation that it suggests. But the need to mail something assumes distance in space or time, or as in this case, in death and understanding. Blake clearly saw Thoreau's mailing as a kind of infinite bulk mailing for present generations and beyond. Waiting for a package gives you something to be awake about. Some people I've read today are afflicted with mail order compulsion. They cannot refrain from buying stuff online just so that they can feel that something is on its way. Thoreau's correspondence with Blake began while he was immersed in extensive revisions of his first book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, which was published the following year in 1849. Both, I'm going to call it Concord and Merrimack for short. People frequently call it A Week for short, but then when you say in a week, it sounds like you're talking about in a scale of time and not in the book. So I'm going to call it Concord and Merrimack for short. Both Concord and Merrimack and Walden are actual journeys that are idealized. Both are biographical and metaphorical retreats and returns. Walden, the much better known book, gives an account, of course, of 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days that Thoreau lived in a cabin he built in the woods that belonged to Emerson, near the shore of Walden Pond. Thoreau started writing Walden during his pondside retreat, but the bulk and the finish of the book occurred after he left the woods in 1847 to live again in Concord. Just like a fig tree, the tree of experience has two fruitings for Thoreau, the lived and the reflected. The second yielded the more important harvest. Reflection is not passive capture by memory. It's an active processing of experience. Reflection is not a static, lifeless image of what was once real life. It is life. It is experience of another order. A passage from one of Thoreau's letters is illuminating in this regard. Blake had mentioned that he had taken a hike to the top of Mount Washington, and Thoreau encourages him then to essay about it. State to yourself precisely and completely what that walk over the mountains amounted for you, returning to this essay again and again until you're satisfied that all that was important in your experience is in it. Don't suppose that you can tell it precisely the first dozen times you try, but keep at it. Again, especially where, after a sufficient pause, you suspect that you are touching the heart or summit of the matter. Not that the story need be long, but it will take a long while to make it short. It did not take very long to get over the mountain, you thought, but have you got over it indeed? If you have been to the top of Mount Washington, let me ask, what did you find there? What is the way they prove witnesses? That is the way they prove witnesses, you know. Going up there and being blown on is nothing. We never do much climbing while we are there. It is only after we get home that we really go over the mountain, if ever. This passage is a precious window for revealing Thoreau's meticulous rewriting process. Don't suppose that a dozen rewrites will get you there, right? But keep at it. He's famously known for the painstaking rewrite of Walden 7 whole times in the period of 6 years that he was working on it. But notice in the end, it isn't really about the writing at all, but about reflection. We don't care that the feet climb the mountain. We care that the head and heart do, and that's your homework. Isn't this another expression, really, of still in the mail? What a concept. That my adventures forward messages to myself. That unassimilated experience is really unread mail. I know a teacher who has her graduating students write letters to their future selves. She holds on to them for a year or two and then drops them in the mail. She may be in this room, actually. From the time Thoreau left the woods, it would be 7 years before Walden was published. The book that actually occupied his prime attention during the Walden retreat, and of which he completed a full draft while he was there, it wasn't Walden, but A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, which was an account of a boating trip in a 15-foot fisherman's dory that Thoreau and his brother John took in 1839. So Thoreau would have been 22 at the time. Again, reflection is the most important species of experience. This book was published 10 years after the trip. A tribute to John Thoreau, who died from tetanus in the arms of Henry in early 1842, 3 years after the river trip. Concord and Merrimack is about 315 pages, longer than Walden by about 20%. And like the latter, it alternates actual narrative with critical reflection. But to be more accurate, Concord and Merrimack braids together three strands: narrative, criticism, and verse. The actual 2-week September trip is condensed into a single week in his retelling, with 7 chapters named after the 7 days of the week. It shoves off with an end of the summer Saturday, and it returns in a nostalgic hue of an autumn-tinctured Friday. John is never named in the book. No personal portrait is drawn, conversation between them never quoted. Some personal activities, preparing camp, handling or mishandling food, brief portraits of persons that are met along the way, floating of a watermelon to keep it cold, and they're singing, they're stargazing, all these are referenced. But this is not a book that follows the dramatic arc of a personal relationship. The brothers' feelings toward one another are never addressed. We certainly see no hint of the universal law of modern family vacations, you know, conflict erupting as the shackles of domestic habit are lifted, emotional meltdown halfway through, fragile reconciliation on the way home. Impersonality, as Blake says. It wasn't Thoreau's style or angle or interest to get too distracted by personal friction. Early in their correspondence, he wrote to Blake, "You ask if there's no doctrine of sorrow in my philosophy. Of acute sorrow, I suppose that I know comparatively little. My saddest and most genuine sorrows are apt to be but transient regrets. The place of sorrow is supplied, perchance, by a certain hard and proportionately barren indifference. I'm akin to the sod, and partake largely of its dull patience. I'm apt to think that it isn't my business to be seeking the spirit, but as much its business to be seeking me." Braid is the right word. The three elements in the braid never lose their individuality, never weave their fibers together. Thoreau's attempts at transitions in the book are often feeble. But mostly, he makes no attempts really to hide the seams. After all, he thought virile art was rough-finished and innocent of self-consciousness. Quote, "There's a soberness in a rough aspect, as of unhewn granite, which addresses a depth in us, but a polished surface hits only the ball of the eye." He may have been preempting criticism of this sort when he wrote, early in the book, "Enough has been said in these days of the charm of fluent writing. We hear it complained of some works of genius that they have fine thoughts but are irregular and have no flow. But even the mountain peaks in the horizon are, to the eye of science, parts of one range. We should consider that the flow of thought is more like a tidal wave than a prone river, and is the result of celestial influence, pulling on it, not any of the declivity in the channel. The river flows because it runs downhill," his suggestion, like certain kinds of thought. and it flows faster and faster as it descends. The reader who expects to float downstream for the whole voyage may well complain of nauseating swells and choppings of the sea. Well, I don't know if I would say the transitions are nauseating swells and choppings of the sea, but the book is not easy reading. The circumstantial narrative can be tedious. However, his descriptive powers are often wonderful. In picturesque prose, he describes the natural features and the rivers, the hills, the towns, plants and animals. In the passing of a town or a bridge, he can steer the prose into a historical tangent. The verse varies in quality, and it erupts from the prose anywhere and everywhere. Sometimes he's quoting other poets without citation. After all, liberal borrowing was no sin in the mid-19th century. And there are far-ranging literary allusions that are a big stretch for most of us today. The verse can be cute and jingly or carefully metered. It can be satirical, or it can be mystically abstruse, and occasionally sublime, and there's a lot of it, which suggests that he cherished ambitions to succeed as a poet, likely cherishing too closely a prediction Emerson made of him when they had first met. 5 years later, with the publication of Walden, Thoreau seems to have scaled back that ambition, or he was perhaps counseled about style, readability, commercial viability. Concord and Merrimack was a commercial failure. He personally paid for the printing, and after 3 years, the printer returned to him 706 copies of the original 1,000. Ouch. He quipped in his journal, "I have now a library of nearly 900 volumes, over 700 of which I wrote myself." The third strand, the critical exposition, is what attracts me most. It's where Thoreau excels. The philosopher, that is, the 19th century brand, not what we talk about today in the academy, the philosopher holding forth on friendship, religion, work, science, books, poetry, lively, informed, well-argued, opinionated, eloquent, rash, biting. His wit is pointed and often wrapped in tight conceit and metaphor. Thoreau naturally exudes parable and succeeds in striking the insight that he doesn't say outright, that must be approached at a slant. Emerson had written in his essay, Nature, that primary writers burst the rotten diction of derivative thinkers and, quote, fasten words to visible things. Picturesque language, Emerson said, is at once a commanding certificate of he who employs it, is a man in alliance with truth and God. Thoreau's parabolic or analogical propensity can be gauged by statements he makes in Concord and Merrimack about poetry. He says, "There is no doubt that the loftiest written wisdom is either rhymed or in some way musically measured, is in form as well as substance poetry. And a volume which should contain the condensed wisdom of mankind need not have one rhymeless line." Again, he says, poetry is the mysticism of mankind. The expressions of the poet cannot be analyzed. His sentence is one word. His syllables are words. There are indeed no words quite worthy to be set to his music. But what matter if we do not hear the words always, if we hear the music? He says, "It is only by a miracle that poetry is written at all. It is not recoverable thought, but a hue caught from a vaster receding thought." This kind of eludes you. You see the way he says something in passing, and you catch the hue of it as you're passing by. If we would approach an understanding of what Thoreau means by poetry, we have to set aside our conception of verse and the craft of versification. The poet may express herself in verse as an apple may appear on a tree. The apple is the outcome of life, but it's not the life itself. The sap flows whether the fruit appears or not. So, poetry is the inner life, prior, not dependent on any written word. It is poetic vision or imagination, a state of consciousness. Quote, the poet sings how the blood flows in his veins. His song is a vital function like breathing, and an integral result like weight. It is not the overflowing of life, but its subsistence rather, and is drawn from under the feet of the poet. Furthermore, the poem or expression may be a word or an act for Thoreau. And the true poet makes no distinction between the two. As he wrote of Sir Walter Raleigh, the consummate Elizabethan man of action and letters, quote, the word which is best said came nearest to not being spoken at all. For it is cousin to a deed which the speaker could have better done. Nay, almost it must have taken the place of a deed by some urgent necessity, even by some misfortune, so that the truest writer will be some captive knight, after all. Of course, he's referring to the fact that Raleigh wrote most when he was imprisoned, when he couldn't act. Thoreau's life is an experiment and an example of a new man of letters. Emerson had announced his vision of the American scholar years earlier, the fully integrated individual of head, hands, and heart. But still, Emerson articulated his vision from an armchair, even as he celebrated a new American culture that would uplift the craftsman who builds the chair. This was not just an issue of economic inclusion for workers who had been historically disenfranchised, but intellectual and spiritual inclusion. This was a new spiritual solution for the perennial caste problems and class warfare. The bottom must be brought up in a whole person sense, and America had the advantage of a new start with whole oceans to wash away the memory of tired institutional oppressions of the old world. But the scholar, too, had to be brought down. The notion of a man of letters as a cloistered, effete, intellectual, weak in practical power, and estranged from instinct and spontaneous emotion, that, too, was a thing of the past. Here's a great passage. It's a little long from Thoreau in this regard. Men have a respect for scholarship and learning greatly out of proportion to the use they commonly serve. Can there be any greater reproach than idle learning? Learn to split wood, at least. The necessity of labor and conversation with many men and things to the scholar is rarely well remembered. Steady labor with the hands, which engrosses the attention also, is unquestionably the best method for removing palaver and sentimentality out of one's style, both in speaking and writing. If he has worked hard from morning till night, though he may have grieved that he could not spend more time watching his train of thoughts during that time, yet the hasty few lines which at evening record his day's experience will be more musical and true than his freest but idle fancy could have furnished. Surely the writer is to address a world of laborers, and such, therefore, must be his own discipline. That's a great Whitman-esque line. Today's Whitman's birthday, 195th. Yeah. Surely the writer is to address a world of laborers, and such, therefore, must be his own discipline. He will not idly dance at his work, who has wood to cut and cord before nightfall in the short days of winter. But every stroke will be husbanded and ring soberly through the wood, and so will the strokes of that scholar's pen, which at evening record the story of that day and ring soberly yet cheerily on the ear of the reader long after the echoes of his acts have died away. The scholar may be sure that he writes the tougher truth for the calluses on his palms. They give firmness to the sentence. Indeed, the mind never makes a great and successful effort without a corresponding energy of the body. We are often struck by the force and precision of style to which hard-working men, unpracticed in writing, easily attain when required to make the effort, as if plainness and vigor and sincerity the ornaments of style were better learned on the farm and in the workshop than in the schools. The sentences written by such rude hands are nervous and tough, like hardened thongs, the sinews of the deer, the roots of the pine. That's a different view of scholarship, isn't it? This vision of the sinewed and fibered writer, of intellectual energy as the afterglow of dutiful muscular life, was, as I mentioned, anticipating Walt Whitman's vision. Thoreau and Whitman were both spiritual heirs to Emerson, born only 2 years apart, lifelong bachelors and working men. Personally, they seemed to inhabit the new American scholar ideal better than Emerson himself. Whitman was a legendary autodidact with no formal education beyond elementary school. Now, there's more than scholarly reason to keep in mind Thoreau's writing and publishing timelines. There's an important imaginative reason as a reader. As I read Concord and Merrimack, I'm apt to view Thoreau's flights of critical prose as occurring in the context which he presents them along this river trip. But this is not really the case, as the book was written while he was at Walden Pond. There's a strange sense in which Concord and Merrimack may be more truly the product of life at Walden Pond than Walden itself. It's sort of like looking at a star and remembering that you don't see the star as it is now. You're looking into the past. The passage just read, for example, about cutting wood and calloused hands, is so sharp and vital that it seems to carry the body heat of long hours of physical labor that the experiment at Walden sometimes demanded, especially early on as he built his cabin and cleared and planted his field. Another telling passage in this regard directly addresses the idea of retreat, which to me is connected with renew and reform. This passage would be much more meaningful in the context of Walden than in Concord and Merrimack, where we find it, because it contains the image of snow. And, of course, the Concord and Merrimack trip was in September. There was no snow. It conveys a witty answer to a jarring command issued to Thoreau by his friend, the poet Ellery Channing. Channing had worked as a writer at the time at the New York Tribune. He saw Thoreau visit the Big Apple while Thoreau was working as a tutor on Staten Island, actually for Emerson's brother, only to return to Concord, frayed and disgusted with the urban scene. Thoreau said, "It's 1,000 times meaner than I could have imagined." In a prophetic and likely influential letter, 4 months nearly to the day before Thoreau moved into his cabin, Channing wrote to him from New York, "My dear Thoreau, the handwriting of your letter is so miserable, I'm not sure I've made it out. If I have, it seems to me you're the same old sixpence you used to be, rather rusty, but the genuine piece. I see nothing for you in this earth but that field which I once christened Briars. Go out upon that, build yourself a hut, and there begin the grand process of devouring yourself alive. I see no alternative, no other hope for you. Eat yourself up. You will eat nobody else, nor anything else. Concord is just as good a place as any other." Thoreau seems to answer this exactly in Concord and Merrimack. The poet is he that hath fat enough, like bears and marmots, to suck his claws all winter. He hibernates in this world and feeds on his own marrow. We love to think in winter, as we walk over the snowy pastures, of those happy dreamers that lie under the sod, of dormice and all that race of dormant creatures, which have such a superfluity of life enveloped in the thick folds of their fur that they're impervious to cold. Alas, the poet, too, in one sense, is a sort of dormouse, gone into winter quarters of deep and serene thoughts, insensible to surrounding circumstances. Other men lead a starved existence, meanwhile, like hawks that would fain keep on the wing and trust to pick up a sparrow now and then. So there's the why the poet can retreat and hibernate. In fact, it was Thoreau's ideas about solitude and retreat from society that attracted Harrison Blake in the first place. The sole existent letter we have from Blake to Thoreau, the first, the one that inaugurated the correspondence, includes these lines. He says to Thoreau, "When I was last in Concord, you spoke of retiring farther from our civilization." So this is just, they met just before Thoreau had left. "I asked you if you would feel no longings for society of your friends. Your reply was in substance, 'No, I'm nothing.' That reply was memorable to me. It indicated a depth of resources, a completeness of renunciation, a poise and repose in the universe, which to me is almost inconceivable. Upon me seems to be a dawning a new significance, the idea that God is here, that we have but to bow before him in profound submission at every moment, and he will fill our souls with his presence. In this opening of the soul to God, all duty seems to center. What else have we to do? If I understand rightly the significance of your life, this is it. You would sunder yourself from society, from the spell of institutions and customs and conventionalities, that you may lead a fresh, simple life with God. I honor you because you abstain from action and open your soul that you may be somewhat. Amid the world of noisy, shallow actors, it is noble to stand aside and say, 'I will simply be.'" Now, this to be and to do, this contemplation and action, the body and the spirit, this perennial paradox, was the impetus for the whole correspondence. Blake couldn't have asked a better thinker alive. We say that in hindsight now, but actually in 1848, Thoreau was not Thoreau, not the writer we know who reduced his life to its simplest terms in order to sort out the necessary from the inessential. Not yet. He had no books to his name. Concord and Merrimack was a year out. Walden was not forthcoming for 6 more years. In fact, it makes you wonder whether and to what extent Blake, the earnest inquirer, influenced the painstaking revisions of that book prior to publication. He may well have occupied the mind of Thoreau as the type of reader hungry for his message in Walden. The letters themselves are full of encouragement and goading, pithy wisdom, rants about the newspapers, far-out insinuations of spiritual identity, social criticism, also mundane reports about visits and lecturing. There are 2 supplemental essays on love and sex, believe it or not, The Lifelong Bachelor and Celibate, that Thoreau pulled together from his journals to give guidance to Blake when the 6-year widower and father was poised to remarry in 1852. Fortunately, finding a kindred spirit, he was anxious for advice on maintaining the elevated tone of the relationship. Yet the core theme that most occurs is the one occupying Blake's first letter. How can we meet the needs of the body without sacrificing the life of the spirit? How can we follow the spirit and not starve? The guileless tone and ideal premises expressed by Blake in that one letter that is preserved are not so much wrong as immature, perhaps, and overly simplified. Would Thoreau sunder himself from society? Yes, at intervals, but largely to take a critical perspective that would reveal more meaningful involvement. Is the opening of the soul to God all one has to do in order to be upheld in this world? Does an elevated mode of being eliminate all need for doing? Certainly not. Not for Thoreau. But a vibrant inner life may inspire and energize the outer life, and may in fact result in a comparative indifference to it, so that it may be strengthened by a benign neglect, like a shrub on a hillside. In one passage, he gives a render unto Caesar sort of answer, a position advocating just proportion. Thoreau writes, Was there ever a genuine dilemma? The laws of the earth are for the feet, the inferior man. The laws of heaven are for the head, or the superior man. Happy the man who observes the heavenly and the terrestrial law in just proportion, whose every faculty from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head obeys the laws of its own level. Frequently, the biblical metaphor of daily bread comes up. Some modes of obtaining the body's bread are clearly foolish to the eyes of Thoreau. Do men know nothing? I know many men who in common things are not to be deceived, who trust no moonshine, who count their money correctly, and who know how to invest it, who are said to be prudent and knowing, who yet will stand at a desk the greater part of their lives as cashiers in banks, in glimmer and rust, and finally go out there. I apologize if there's any bankers in the room. If they know anything, what under the sun do they do that for? Do they know what bread is or what it is for? Do they know what life is? If they knew something, the places which know them now would know them no more forever. Man must earn his bread by the sweat of his brow, truly, but also by the sweat of his brain within his brow. The mode of obtaining the earthly bread might be ideally related to our spiritual needs, however. He says, "How shall we earn our bread is indeed a grave question, yet it is a sweet and inviting question. Let's not shirk it, as is usually done. It is the most important and practical question which is put to man. Let us not answer it hastily. It is as true actually as it is really. It is true materially as it is spiritually, that they who seek honestly and sincerely with all their hearts and lives and strength to earn their bread do earn it. And it is sure to be very sweet to them. A very little bread, a few crumbs, are enough." And again, "Our bread need not ever be sour or hard to digest. What nature is to the mind, she is to the body. As she feeds my imagination, she will feed my body, and what she says she means and is ready to do. She's not simply beautiful to the poet's eye. Not only the rainbow and the sunset are beautiful, but to be fed and clothed and sheltered and warmed aright are equally beautiful and inspiring." And yet this is clearly not a philosophy for Thoreau of resignation and conformity. You cannot find the ideal unity of body and spirit simply by changing your attitude about existing conditions. He says in one passage to Blake, and we can only infer what Blake has asked since Blake destroyed all his letters except the first one, but Thoreau's often specifically answering certain comments. He says, "As for conforming outwardly and living your own life inwardly, I do not think much of that. Let not your right hand know what your left hand does in that line of business. It will prove a failure. Just as successfully can you walk against a sharp steel edge which divides you cleanly right and left." Prior to Blake's remarrying, at which time he came into some financial ease, he seemed to be complaining about the press of the world. Thoreau says, "All the world complains nowadays about the press of trivial duties and engagements, which prevents their employing themselves on some higher ground they know not of. But undoubtedly, if they were made of the right stuff to work on that higher ground, provided they were released from all those engagements, they would now at once fulfill the superior engagement and neglect all the rest as naturally as they breathe. They would never be caught saying that they had no time for this, when the dullest man knows that this is all he has time for. No man who acts from a sense of duty ever puts the lesser duty above the greater. No man has the desire and the ability to work on high things but he has also the ability to build himself a high staging. This concept of higher ground becomes the metaphor of upland farm in the letters. And Thoreau, in accordance with the principle of separating the right hand from the left, tells Blake that cultivation in that region need not be brought to the market. Some absorbing employment on your higher ground, your upland farm, whither no cart path leads, and where you mount alone with your hoe, where life everlasting grows. There you raise a crop which needs not to be brought down into the valley to market. Later, when Blake came into money and desired to productively use his leisure for higher purposes, Thoreau offered this advice, which touches on the money and the higher life issue. Thoreau says, "The problem of life becomes more complicated as our material wealth is increased. Since the problem is not merely nor mainly to get life for our bodies, but by this or similar discipline to get life for our souls. By cultivating the lowland farm on right principles, that is, with this view, to turn it into an upland farm. I see that in my own case, money might be of great service to me, but probably it would not be. For the difficulty now is that I do not improve my opportunities, and therefore I'm not prepared to have my opportunities increased. Now I warn you, if it be as you say, you have got to put the pack of an upland farmer in good earnest the coming spring. The lowland farm now being cared for, you must be selecting your seeds forthwith and doing what winter work you can. And while others are raising potatoes and Baldwin apples for you, you must be raising apples of the Hesperides for them." Yet Blake continued to puzzle about the apparent conflict of being and doing and his practical place in the world. Thoreau drew a harder line, illustrated with a very vivid nature metaphor. "You speak of doing and being, and the vanity, real or apparent, of much doing." So this really addresses the very first letter. "The other day I opened a muskrat's house. It was made of weeds, 5 feet broad at the base, 3 feet high, and far and low within it was this little cavity, only a foot in diameter, where the rat dwelt. It may seem trivial, this piling up of weeds, but so the race of muskrats is preserved. We must heap up a great pile of doing for a small diameter of being." Ooh, that hurt to read, yes. "Is it not imperative on us that we do something, if only working a treadmill? And indeed, some sort of revolving is necessary to produce a center and a nucleus of being. What exercise is to the body, employment is to the mind and morals. Consider what an amount of drudgery must be performed, how much humdrum and prosaic labor goes to any work of lasting value. There are so many layers of mere white lime in every shell, to that thin inner one so beautifully tinted. Work is not merely a police in the gross sense, but in the higher sense, a discipline. If it is surely the means to the highest end we know, can any work be humble or disgusting?" Thoreau knew that his preaching at times sounded too confident and airtight. One of the charms about the letters is that he's constantly letting the air out of it. At the end of a letter, he says, "These things I say, other things I do." Or write me back your wisdom. Or, you know, he's very well aware that there's this discrepancy and he's uncomfortable with it. The truth is that Thoreau himself was grappling with these same problems and was attempting to answer by living the questions, to quote the Austrian poet Rainer Maria Rilke. In the end, he knew that nothing he could write would solve Blake's dilemmas, because Blake could only solve them by his own experience. That was a fundamental tenet of Thoreauvian wisdom, that problems aren't solved by concepts, they're solved by experience. But a mentor can give pointers as to how to go about that experience. Rather than an instructor, Thoreau was a scarecrow scattering the black feathered fears that clouded Blake's awareness. Thoreau writes, "I'm glad to know that I am as much to any mortal as a persistent and consistent scarecrow is to the farmer, such a bundle of straw in a man's clothing as I am, with a few bits of tin to sparkle in the sun dangling about me, as if I were hard at work there in the field. However, if this kind of life saves any man's corn, why, he is the gainer. I am not afraid that you will flatter me, as long as you know what I am, as well as what I think or aim to be, and distinguish between these two. This distinction between what I am and what I aim, as Thoreau puts it, is key to his elevated conception of friendship, expressed in both the letters and in Concord and Merrimack. Friendship is the sacred office of honoring and supporting the best potentials in another. He says, "I value and trust those who love and praise my aspiration rather than my performance. If you would not stop to look at me, but look on whither I am looking and further, then my education could not dispense with your company." He says, "In love and friendship, the imagination is as much exercised as the heart. If either is outraged, the other will be estranged. It is commonly the imagination which is wounded first, rather than the heart. It is so much more sensitive." Imagination for Thoreau was not what we mean by the word today. It wasn't merely fantasy or daydreaming, the private Photoshop in the head. Imagination was the expression of the inner genius, the faculty that attained perception of ideal forms and sensed another and more real world beneath the one revealed to our senses, as well as a more brilliant being within our friend. Quote, "There is only necessary a moment's sanity and sound senses to teach us that there is a nature behind the ordinary, in which we have only some vague preemption right and Western reserve as yet. We live on the outskirts of that region. This world has many rings, like Saturn, and we live now on the outermost of them all. I am not without hope that we may, even here and now, obtain some accurate information concerning that other world, which is the instinct of mankind, so long predicted." The empiricist side of Thoreau did not advocate turning away from the senses, however. Quote, "Did not he that made that which is within make that which is without also? What is it then to educate but to develop these divine germs called the senses? We need pray for no higher heaven than the pure senses can furnish, a purely sensuous life. Our present senses are but the rudiments of what they are destined to become. The ears were made not for such trivial uses as men are wont to suppose, but to hear celestial sounds. The eyes were not made for such groveling uses as they are put to now, but to behold beauty that is now invisible. May we not see God? Are we to put off and amused in this life, as it were, with a mere allegory?" This imagination, equivalent to what he calls in other places the poetic faculty or intuition, becomes active in human relationships as love. Although, quote, "love must be a light as much as a flame," it is still a flame. Inspiration runs ahead of comprehension for Thoreau. The matutine intellect of the poet stays in advance of the noontide glare of philosophy. The imagination is satisfied before the understanding is gratified. Friendship, he says, is never established as an understood relationship. It is an exercise in the purest imagination and the rarest faith. He writes, what is commonly honored with the name of friendship is no very profound or powerful instinct. Men do not, after all, love their friends greatly. I do not see the farmers made seers and wise to the verge of insanity by their friendships one to the other. They're not often transfigured and translated by love in each other's presence. I do not observe them purified and refined and elevated by the love of a man. Friendship, then, for Thoreau, is much more than behaving in a benign and civil manner. It is inseparable from yearning for truth and authenticity. It makes room, therefore, for the negative as well as the positive. In Emerson's essay on self-reliance, he shockingly wrote, "Speak the rude truth in all ways. Truth is handsomer than the affectation of love. Your goodness must have some edge to it, else it is none. The doctrine of hatred must be preached as the counteraction of the doctrine of love when that pules and whines. I shun father and mother and wife and brother when my genius calls me." Of course, this is less shocking when we realize Emerson was paraphrasing the New Testament and giving a fresh and sectarian interpretation to Jesus' statement that his way should separate a man from his family if a side must be taken. Thoreau, too, wrote that friendship must have some edge. He says, "Can love be in aught allied to dissipation? Let us love by refusing, not accepting one another." And again, there are times when we have had enough even of our friends, when we begin inevitably to profane one another and must withdraw religiously into solitude and silence, the better to prepare ourselves for a loftier intimacy. He made the same point with humorous pungency in Walden. Society is commonly too cheap. We meet at very short intervals, not having had enough time to acquire any new value for each other. We meet at meals 3 times a day and give each other a new taste of that old musty cheese that we are. We haven't had time to acquire, we haven't gone through experiences, we haven't acquired anything new. There's no new harvest. But going back to the image of a religious withdrawal from friends, the better to prepare ourselves for loftier intimacy, this is Thoreauvian retreat in a nutshell, isn't it? Whether it be up a river for 2 weeks, or into the woods for 2 years, or only to our local botanical gardens for 2 hours. The retreat, of course, is a distancing of oneself from the familiar and the habitual in order to experience something else. It is a withdrawal for renewal. But it is really more than that. Retreat is a distancing of yourself from yourself, that the two may be forced to communicate only by mail, so to speak. After all, were there no distance, there would be no need for the mail. And we all know that a handwritten note is frequently the best beginning for the repair of a relationship, where a face-to-face encounter would likely trigger familiar defenses and reactions. How much more effective, then, is a written message from our own estranged genius? Thoreau knew that visitations from the inner genius are fleeting and should be heeded, though the world condemns them as baseless whim, to use Emerson's phrase. Even if our encounters with the best persons and the best states of mind are rare, we can still enjoy their written testimony as we wait by the mailbox. And here's my last quote from him. "Read the best books first, or you may not have the chance to read them at all." Certainly, we do not need to be soothed and entertained always like children. Books, not which afford us a cowering enjoyment, but in which each thought is of unusual daring, such as an idle man cannot read and a timid one would not be entertained by, which even make us dangerous to existing institutions. Such I call good books. Thank you.
Thank you.